Hey, baseball fans, it's time to swing big on your bets this season. Step up to the plate with an odds boost token from BetMGM, an official sports betting partner of Major League Baseball. No opt-in is required. Just log into your BetMGM account to receive your odds boost token. Then, place a bet on any MLB game and activate your token. If your boosted bet hits, you'll score a bigger payout, no matter the showdown. BetMGM is your betting home for baseball. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This U.S. promotion offer not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369. For Arizona, call 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary and expire in 1 to 7 days. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Spring into big savings on all Larson storm doors now at Menards. Larson doors are perfect to enjoy the fresh spring air. Whether you're looking for additional security or a screen door, we have what you need. They come in over 40 styles and 9 colors to choose from. Check out all Larson storm door options in store and find more great deals in our weekly flyer on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
And I mean, the Martin Short scene in Inherent Vice makes sense for that movie, for as much as that movie makes sense to anyone.
Right. Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dyson.
My masterpiece, baby.
It's beautiful.
Miami, I am back. Pow!
You could have just bought this at the store. I think they sold it there.
You sure that's your son, man?
Hello, everybody. It's episode 163 of Wreckatopia. My name is Chris Atkinson, and I'm joined by Aaron Dyson.
Heidely ho, Molten Center Arenos.
And we're also joined by Jeremy Scott.
It's fucking Molten, you asshole!
Yes, today's big recommend is Chef, if you haven't guessed from the context clues. We are also joined by Chat, who have come out here to watch us on a Thursday morning for the first time in a while, but we'll be back on Tuesday before you know it. Let's start off with our small recommends.
It's no big deal.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
And Jeremy, what do you got?
Ooh, I watched the movie Sing Sing 5 or 6 days ago on Max. If you have not heard, Time Warner has made the genius decision to rename Max HBO Max of the HBO name they were taking advantage of back when it used to be called HBO Max, and they changed it to just Max. All I knew about this movie was that Coleman Domingo was nominated, and it was about the prison, Sing Sing. I hadn't seen any trailers. And so my idiot brain just assumed it was a standard prison movie that I could get to whenever I got to. It just happened to come on HBO. I had nothing to do at the moment. I watched it. Holy shit! This is so not a standard prison movie. And this is a love letter to theater and the arts. And it would pair really well with Shawshank Redemption, even though it is a bit of a different movie. But Coleman Domingo's playing an innocent man in prison who is part of basically rehabilitation through the arts is a program that's a real program at Sing Sing. And some of the people in the cast of this movie were actual prisoners who were in the program when they were in Sing Sing. And Coleman Domingo's character proves to be just an incredible actor with soul and range and a really talented writer. And it's just heartbreaking how that impacts his life in good and bad ways. And there's another character that it's sort of his tandem protagonist, if you will. And unlike Shawshank, they don't get along all the time. In fact, they butt heads frequently and even almost fight on their way to a friendship that is really, really satisfying. I can't recommend this movie enough. I was blown away and wish I'd gotten to it sooner.
Love the hell out of Sing Sing. It was one of the many movies that I watched in that marathon of movies going towards the end of the year review that we did. And I would also second this recommendation.
Third.
Sing Sing's great. It was one of a few art as therapy movies last year that really kind of spoke to how performing or even just being involved intricately in creating something can teach you things about yourself and actually perform real therapeutical work. And so, Sing Sing's great.
I'm just glad to see Coleman Domingo become kind of he's not exactly household yet, I don't think. I don't think a lot of people still know who he is, but two Oscar nominations in a row now, and he's he's just so excellent, so good.
He really is.
Yeah, so I'll go ahead and do my small recommend. I read a book that Jonathan had recommended to me, I don't know how many months ago it was, but it is getting a movie adaptation. I think it came out on drive-in theaters last week, and it did pretty well. And then I guess it has either a limited or semi-wide release that is either coming up or has come. I don't know when it's supposed to come out, but it's called Clown in a Cornfield, and it's by Adam Cesare. I'm going to go ahead and say it's Cesare. I don't know. I looked up interviews trying to find his name. I can't find it. So if you know what it is, I don't want to know. His name is Adam Cesare. the book is about a girl and her dad who moved from Pennsylvania to Missouri after an incident that happens with their mom. This is a triggering thing, so if you can look that up if you want to. But they move to Missouri, and she starts to befriend the popular kids who are also the troublemaking kids in this small town. And they like to dress up as clowns for whatever reason. It's sort of the town mascot, and they like to dress up as them and everything. And then this is all leading to a big party out into a cornfield. It's amazing reading this book, like, oh, that's where we're headed. This is going to be the main part of the book for the rest of the time, is this party in a cornfield. And that is when people start dying, and I won't say much more than that, because you want to read it for yourself and you want to find out what's going on. But I really enjoyed this book. It was a very fast read. I got it done in like a couple of days, I think. It was definitely a page turner, and definitely one that I would recommend if you're looking for a good book to read. And I definitely read this because the movie was coming out. I sort of pushed it up my queue basically to read it, and I will see the movie eventually, but I've been hearing mixed things about that. So don't know what to think about that, but I will watch the movie at some point anyway.
I can't think, after all my life's movie watching, I can't think of a good reason for me to ever go into a cornfield. Like,
Dreams? I mean, come on. You know,
that would be fucking creepy, man. That would be creepy. When I was a kid, there was a cornfield next to the church, and we would run in there and play, probably trespassing. But now that I've seen all these movies, I don't think there's no reason for me to go in there. So I'm just not going to.
Probably not.
Yeah. Well, and Children of the Corn. That's another. I mean, Children of the Corn.
Plus, every time in a movie somebody's being chased and they run into a cornfield, bad things happen.
Exactly.
Bad things happen.
The corn hides all the bad things. Have you read any other books by Adam Cesare?
I have not, although I do have the two sequels to this book. Lying in Wait. Yes, there's a two and a three for this.
Wow.
I have not read any others by Adam Caesar. So
is it like, is it Clown in a Cornfield 2 or is it like Clown in a Forest?
It's Clown in a Cornfield. All of them are Clown in a Cornfield. Clown in a Cornfield 2, and then, yeah, I won't even go into the subtitles because I think even the subtitles of those books kind of, like, spoiled tiny bits of reading for me. Nothing major, but just, you know, I was like, oh, okay, I kind of see where this is going. Anyway, that's my small recommend.
I will finish this off with a recommend of a musical documentary about the Bee Gees called The Bee Gees, How Can You Mend a Broken Heart? This is on HBO Max. My awareness of the Bee Gees was pretty much Stayin' Alive, and I, you know, knew some of their other songs, and then also Justin Timberlake on SNL with Fallon doing, you know, the Gibb Brothers talk show or whatever. I found this documentary not only well done, but really, really educational for me, really enlightening. And I love it when a doc can do that. And for me, the insight was how integral these guys were to pop music for an extended amount of time. It wasn't just the disco thing, which, you know, the documentary goes into. They really felt weird about being called disco because, you know, they'd been around since the 60s doing music, and so to be pigeonholed into that was weird for them, and kind of the you know, disco sucks movement, you know, of the what was that, the 80s, when kind of that was the big thing and they were burning records in Wrigley Field and all that kind of stuff, kind of destroyed them in some ways. And then as a songwriter, I blew my mind, like how many songs, I think it's Barry, how many songs that he has written that are just hit songs from artists you would never think. I found this really interesting and even more than that, really meaningful, really moving. It's a really moving story about these brothers and their trials. And I think Barry's the only one alive now. So that's part of it too, is like he's, you know, he's the only one around, and the movie kind of goes into that too. So, yeah, this is good stuff. I think it's on Max. I'm sorry, HBO Max, and you can check it out there.
So, All right. Okay, let's go on to our big recommend, which is Chef, and it is Jeremy's big recommend. So, Jeremy, take it away.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
There may be times during this recap where it seems like I'm kind of sinning the movie instead of recapping it. And I assure you, friends, I am doing both at the same time. Here we go. We open on Jon Favreau's Chef Carl Casper in his restaurant's kitchen doing all kinds of amazing-looking food things as he preps the day's menu. And while you might be tempted to think there are clever cuts here, hiding who is actually doing the knife work and such, Favreau actually went to an intense French cooking school, and a lot of these shots are legitimately him. Soon, Leguizamo's Martin arrives with a whole pig, which Carl sets to butchering immediately. This is one thing I know would keep me from ever being a chef, is butchering a whole animal. Couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. Carl realizes he's late and goes to pick up his son, Percy. And on the way to the farmer's market, he derides food trucks because he's a chef. And apparently food trucks are beneath chefs or something. At the market, Percy asks for kettle corn, and Carl lectures him about how much better fruit is for him before we cut to them sharing a bag of kettle corn, which is good because I wasn't super loving a guy Carl's size lecturing his skinny son about eating more fruits and less carbs. While eating andouille sausages, Carl waxes poetic about how New Orleans food, specifically beignets, and how New Orleans inspired food can be good, but it's nothing like real New Orleans food. And Percy suggests they go sometime, and goddamn, I did not remember this movie being so blatantly foreshadowing. Mm-hmm. It is mentioned several times that there is a reviewer coming to the restaurant tonight, and we see Carl arrive at the restaurant and start reminding all the employees about the reviewer. Molly, Scarlett Johansson, the hostess, comes back to report that Reva is here, and Reva is the owner, and he proceeds to flat out refuse to let Carl cook his own menu, insisting that the same tired menu from every night be used despite the reviewer. He uses a very thin analogy of if you bought Stones tickets and Jagger didn't play Satisfaction, you burn the place to the ground, and I'm not even sure that's accurate, because Satisfaction might be one of the 10 most overplayed songs in all of human history. And I'd be absolutely fine seeing the Stones in concert and hearing Monkey Man over Satisfaction. Anyway, he does say it's up to Carl, but it's clear that it isn't. Forced to cook a stale and tired menu, Carl and his team fail to impress the critic, who is Oliver Platt, though we don't learn that yet. Later, over drinks with the staff, Carl reads the review aloud, which honestly, you should never do that. And who publishes a review a couple hours after dining? The review is bad, really bad, and Carl takes it personally. He smokes some weed with Molly, and she tries to cheer him up and tell him he's a good chef, but he's fixated on being both pleasing both regular customers and getting critical accolades. He leans in to kiss her, and she says, I thought we both agreed not to do this. And he says, let me cook you something. And she says, oh, fuck it, let's go. And a lot of people probably underestimate how sexy good cooking can be. But also, is this a transaction? Never mind, we don't have time for that. Next, we see him picking up Percy, who says, Mom wants to talk to you. He goes inside, and his ex-wife, Inez, clearly cares about him, even as she chides him for being so late. It should be clear to everyone right now that at this point in the film, Carl is a terrible father with bad priorities. Next, we get the scene that will make you hungry even if you just ate, as Carl preps a fully new menu concept for the restaurant, inspired by the bad review to make things new. Everything looks incredible and is surely awesome. Then Martin comes in, is excited about the new food, and says, fuck Twitter, man. And Tony comes in and says the same thing when he arrives. And Carl is curious, but doesn't push too hard, because in this instance, he has good instinct. Next, we see him make the most amazing grilled cheese sandwich for Percy, and he asks his son about Twitter. Percy helps him set up an account, and they find the viral negative tweet about him from the reviewer. Later, after Percy is asleep, Carl decides to privately message the reviewer, telling him he wouldn't know a good meal if it sat on his face. Satisfied and full of misguided confidence, Carl goes to bed as his not-private DM but actually very public reply tweet goes mega-viral. In the morning, as he makes breakfast, Percy discovers that Carl got 1,600 new Twitter followers overnight. The reviewer replied. Back at work, Carl replies again, inviting him down to taste a brand new menu. He drops Percy off because he has a lot to do and has a lot on his mind and is a bad father. Inez encourages him to talk to her publicist and consider food trucks again, but he rebuffs both. Reva refuses to let Carl make the new menu, and it results in Carl quitting. And I'm beginning to think Carl has a bit of an impulsiveness problem. Carl goes home with all the new menu ingredients he bought and cooks his new menu at home anyway. And it looks amazing, but also just as wasteful as if he'd thrown all those ingredients in the trash because no one is there to eat his new menu in his apartment. Marcel, the critic, Oliver Platt, arrives to the restaurant and is bewildered to be served the same menu. He tweets about it. Carl sees it and rushes to the restaurant to very publicly confront Marcel. He hilariously opens with, I'm not cloying, I'm not needy, I don't care what you think, you're not getting to me, which is exactly word for word, I shit you not, what I told my college girlfriend after she dumped me for being too clingy. The entire exchange is filmed and posted online, and now Carl is interested in the publicist, but it's too late for her to help because he's gone too far, unless he wants to be on Hell's Kitchen. And I can't quite make out the view count of the video they show on YouTube, but it looks to be between 1 and 10,000, which is hilariously low, but whatever. Carl goes to the bar to commiserate with his former staff and tells them he'll be fine. Outside, though, he is more honest with Molly, telling her he doesn't have any prospects, which gives her the opportunity to be honest with him and telling him he's blowing it as a father. And I'm really glad this character is the one to say this because she's currently the only person he will really listen to and be real with right now. Carl then goes to visit his son, and Inez suggests they all go to Miami together to visit her father. She underscores what Molly said about Percy being hurt and needing time with his father, so Carl agrees to go. First stop in Miami is a music club in Little Havana. And I love that Percy goes, like Grand Theft Auto? where Inez's father is performing in the band. You can see the music loosen everyone up and the family begins to have a good time. At dinner afterwards, Carl eats a Cuban sandwich that he greatly enjoys. Somewhat instantly, he says, do you think people would like this kind of food back home? Dude, you live in Los Angeles and you aren't sure if people there would like Cuban food? Are you stupid? But anyway, the light bulb goes off a little too quickly for my taste, but I love the movie so much, I just don't care. Carl goes to see Marvin, Inez's ex, who apparently has a food truck opportunity for Carl, and this scene is really just an excuse for Robert Downey Jr. to riff for a bit, but he's so good that I don't mind the cameo. It was just probably very loosely scripted, is what I'm saying. He says his receptionist is pregnant and claims it's And she claims it's Marvin's, and it's supposed to be just like a TMI moment from a powerful man. But he says, I got my tubes tied in 08, so the girl's a fucking liar. And I just need people to know this. A vasectomy is not 100% effective. It is, in fact, 99.85% effective. So this situation is still ending up with a paternity test. The food truck that the very rich man is giving the unemployed man ends up being a total piece of shit. It's old, dirty, grimy, and old. As Carl dismantles it, he talks on the phone with Martin, his former staff member, and tells him about the truck. Inez then shows up and essentially dumps Percy in Carl's lap while also confirming Carl's fears that, yes, she had slept with Marvin after divorcing Carl. Why wouldn't you? He's Robert Downey Jr. And he got his tubes tied, so you're 99.85% sure you're not going to get pregnant. We then get one of my very favorite kinds of movie scenes, a training montage. Wait, nope. I mean the cleaning out the disgusting truck montage. And Carl basically makes Percy his cleaning bitch, making him steal wool and scrub brush the entire truck. When Percy finds a horrible smelling hotel pan in the fridge, he throws it in the garbage. And Carl decides to have a pissing contest and instructs Percy to scrub the pan out by hand. But Percy says, "Why are you so mean to me? And I cleaned out your whole stupid truck," and runs away. Carl then cleans the pan himself and appears to have a learning moment and apologizes to Percy and asks if Percy wants to help him shop for new food truck equipment. At the equipment store, he buys Percy his very own chef's knife. When he needs help loading the equipment into the truck, a sudden Martin appears. And I don't know how the fuck Martin knows where to have this cab drop him off, because it's not like they talked about that beforehand. Carl's even shocked to see him show up and learn he'd quit his new sous chef role. Anyway, because Martin speaks Spanish, he's able to communicate with the nearby workers who had ignored Carl, and they agree to help load the equipment in exchange for being fed. It's all very convenient and entertaining. But seriously, those guys all load that equipment, and then Martin makes like a whole roast of pork, and that shit takes hours, man, not even counting the marinating. My point is, those workers waited ages between their labor and their reward, but while they wait, we get to watch an amazing scene where a mouth-watering Cubano sandwich is constructed. Carl gives Percy conflicting instructions when he tells him to stare at the sandwich on the griddle, and then tells him immediately after that to watch everything everyone is doing. But it's possible I'm just nitpicking. While making Sammy's and serving the workers, Percy attempts to serve a burned sandwich, and Carl uses it as a teaching moment about how important quality and consistency is to a real chef, which is true. Unless they are the chef at the Texas Roadhouse in Snellville, Georgia in 2010 and were responsible for the most vile brown-ass broccoli I've ever seen, so much that I have never been back to any Texas Roadhouse anywhere in the country.
That's very specific there, Jeremy. Very, very
yeah,
specific.
Yeah, that's wild.
That chef did not care about quality and consistency. And in a scene that proves this movie does not take place in reality, they drive the truck the next morning to South Beach, and within 30 seconds of Martin blathering on a megaphone, the food truck is absolutely slammed by customers. Like, this movie makes it look like opening a new food truck is easier than toasting bread. This is the pipe dream first day for a food truck. It's insane that it works so well. He's got, we'll soon learn, 29,000 Twitter followers. And as someone who used to have 125,000 on my former Twitter account, they aren't all in Miami, they aren't all hungry right now, and they aren't all following you because they like you. A cop shows up, inspects a permit, and tells him he has to move the truck, but then recognizes Carl as Lava Cake Guy and asks for a picture with Carl and then some pics in the truck, and it takes forever. After leaving Miami, Percy, who is the food truck's social media manager apparently, tweets, "Thank you, Miami. Check us out on Vine." And Vine. Sorry, I had to take a drink of water. Stopping in New Orleans, Carl finally gets to share native New Orleans food with his son, beignets. And when they get back, there are hundreds of people in line at their not-yet-open food truck. This is not possible. No food truck in the history of food trucks ever has had a line of hundreds of people before opening in a brand-new city when the truck is less than a week old and has 29,000 Twitter followers. This movie lies to you, but it's so good, you forgive it. Percy says he geotagged the truck, and Carl and Martin praise him as a genius, and that's the reason everyone's here, but it's all bullshit. Bigger bullshit is that they somehow have enough ingredients on board to feed a few hundred people inside a couple hours. I'm not even sure there's enough room on here for the bread they need to cover this crowd. I did tell you I was going to be sinning while recapping the movie. I apologize. Then the crew drives from New Orleans to Austin, Texas, set to a New Orleans cover of Sexual Healing, which is strange, especially when the two adults start singing the lyrics in front of a 10-year-old. And honestly, this 10-year-old is going to need lots of therapy later in life, no matter how much he loves his dad at the end of this film. In Austin, as Carl writes the chalkboard out, it's revealed they are selling this Cubano sandwich for only $7. It's 2015, $7? How is this food truck not in the red? Beignets for $3, a Coke for a single dollar? I think the reason Chef Carl Casper was stuck working as a chef for other people who own the restaurant is because Chef Casper is fucking awful at understanding food costs. Anyway, it's the most popular spot in all of Austin, Texas, and they sell a bazillion Cubanos, and good for them. Definitely does look delicious. Inez calls, and in the commotion and bustle of things, Carl says, I love you, and she says it back, and it's a little weird, but only if you don't believe in love, and maybe you never saw Liar Liar. As they celebrate their food truck success and camaraderie, Carl tells Percy that things will probably go back to the way they were when they get back to L.A., because Carl is a better dad now, but he's still got a fucking long way to go and is still a fuck-up. But once he finally watches the 1 second per day video that Percy made, he realizes what a massive positive shift had occurred in their relationship over the trip, and he is moved. He calls Percy immediately and tells him he's going to need his help with the truck over the summer. We then cut to the Disney ending where Marcel, the food critic, comes up to Carl at the food truck event, praises the Cubanos, and says he wants to back the new restaurant with Carl as the head chef. And honestly, this movie is saccharine, but it's also so damn sweet, I'm happy to take all the huge conveniences and all the loose ends tying up super neatly, because it's been a really fun journey. We do end with a final capper scene of the new restaurant venture, which I don't know that we need, but it's nice to see Percy expediting and slapping Marcel's hand away from a tray of food. Oh, and it's a wedding. Wait, please tell me this is not Carl and Inez's second wedding. The movie wouldn't go that far, would it? Please tell me this is a wedding they catered and they're just dancing. Tell me now. Oh, my God. Tell me. Oh. And that is Chef. What did you guys think?
So, yeah, and you're halfway expecting now that we're in 2025 for Oliver Platt to say, I'm going to go fund a restaurant in Chicago after this. You should come. Oliver Platt is cinema sins in this movie, right?
Yeah.
I kind of got that feeling because... And I don't know, I feel like it's meaner in a way because he's actually going to a restaurant that's probably serving him great food, probably tastes really good, and yet he still gives this super negative review just because it's not different enough, which I think is silly. I think you judge, you know, if you're actually a real food critic, you would probably judge based on the quality of the food that you got, not the quality of the food that you didn't get. And, yeah. And so, yeah, he's obviously being a dick for dick purposes and, you know, to get that following and everything. In fact, he, even at the, in the, like when he, they finally have a little discussion, he's like, I thought you were just playing along like I was, you know, I didn't think you were actually like arguing with me about this type of stuff. And, you know, and it goes to show that negative publicity can lead to a huge following because exactly as Bobby Cannavale and John Leguizamo are basically telling him, he's like, half the people agree with what he says, but the other half don't agree with what he says. And then they follow you and then you become a star in that space. It's, finally, someone had the balls to go up to this guy and tell him what he really thought of his review and everything. So, anyway, this movie's fun and breezy, and I love the fact that there is room for a movie like this. There's hardly any conflict. I mean, you're talking about, yeah, he's a divorced dad, and he's kind of got to build that relationship with his son, who he only gets to see every 2 weeks, and you know, he's got the same problems we see in every movie like this, where it's like, work is I can't possibly remember my kid because I'm working so hard. And I don't know if that ever comes off super believable with this particular character that Jon Favreau is playing. You mentioned Liar Liar, and that was I don't want to ruin Aaron's double feature if that's it, but like one that I considered for double feature in this.
Me too.
And because of the exact same issues that are going on in here, although you can believe it more with Jim Carrey's character because he's a lawyer and he's an asshole throughout. Jon Favreau doesn't come off as asshole ever in this movie, really. Not really, anyway. You mentioned the Robert Downey Jr. scene. I don't like it at all. I think it's completely out of place in this movie. I think it's funny in another movie. I think in another movie, this is great. But in this movie, it doesn't have any real impact at all other than, hey, we've been working together for a few years. Why don't you come into my little pet project and play this cameo? And the tone of it is just completely off from the rest of the movie. So I didn't like it one bit. I think it's like mean-spirited in many ways, that whole section. And it's like, okay, great. You got Robert Downey Jr. to do the stupid cameo. And in the end, he gives you just enough money to get a shitty truck. That's great. You know, I just like, you could do without that, right? Like, Jon Favreau could have scrounged up enough dollars from his ex-wife to get a better truck than that. I would have gone to her before going to Robert Downey Jr.
Or just you know, the truck is from the ex-husband, but you don't need to see him necessarily. You certainly don't need, like, I said that it felt largely improvised, and that may not be. Maybe they scripted it, but it's so, you're right about the tone being different, and it's because it's Downey just riffing, and like you said, being mean to Carl, being mean to his receptionist. Mm-hmm. I agree with you on that scene. It's weird.
It reminded me this is not the same scene, but for whatever reason, it reminded me of Inherent Vice, where Martin Short's got the secretary that he's also having sex with. Mm. And in that scene, the Martin Short scene in Inherent Vice makes sense for that movie, for as much as that movie makes sense to anyone.
Right.
But that's what it reminded me of. And I was like, what, are we suddenly in Inherent Vice all of a sudden? We're watching this breezy movie about a guy who starts a food truck, and here's this Robert Downey Jr. cameo where he's basically terrible to women. That's basically all he says the entire time. I'm terrible to women. That's all his dialogue is. I think the best part of this movie is the food, though. Any food movie worth its salt is one that can prepare dishes, kind of like how Big Night did and all that. Mm-hmm. Where you're sitting there watching this movie, going, I want to have that in my mouth right now. Don't take that out of context, people. but like, you know,
that's going on my soundboard.
That's right. You guys mentioned the grilled cheese, which is awesome, but these Cuban sandwiches, I don't like pickles whatsoever. But those pickles in the Cuban sandwich, I might change my mind to eat those. So I love the food in this. I think, yes, it is a total fantasy that you went after a food critic who has a blog, and you got a kind of a following, and then you started a food truck, and then suddenly you're viral overnight and everything. And it's funny to me too. You mentioned that view count on the YouTube video or whatever. Hollywood movies always seem to either underdo it. They're like, oh, 10,000, that's about enough, right? Or they overdo it. Like, oh, this stupid video got 19 million views or something like that. Although that does happen. I will say the overdoing it does happen every once in a while. But you know, it's sort of logically believable in the movie that he would get this kind of a following and then like start a food truck. And then there's people who Twitter's all the rage. Everybody's on Twitter and everything. And they go out to see what his food truck is like and everything. And yes, that wouldn't happen, but it does work for the movie. Everything is kind of works for the movie, esque in this. There's trying to just move on and be a positive movie at the end of the day. Anyway, I really enjoy this movie. I enjoyed the sending of it while you did the synopsis. And let's let Aaron say what his piece.
Oh, this is one of my favorite movies ever. I love it every time I watch it. I love it more. It's interesting. I have several things I do want to say about this movie, but I also have some responses to some of the things that you guys have said that I kind of disagree with. And I did like the sending as always. Always fun, but the Oliver Platt stuff makes complete sense to me. That doesn't feel forced or contrived or convenient. He is the truth teller in this movie. When he gives that review, what he's saying is mean, but it's also true. Like, I think the movie wants us to believe that he believes his job is to not tell a public about a restaurant if it's good or bad. His primary job in his mind feels like, to me, is to keep chefs accountable, right? Like to keep them accountable to what they are capable of. He's like, he seems to consider himself more of a professor or a teacher in that way, like where he's, you know, he had this guy's food and it was creative and amazing. And so he's expecting like this creative, amazing stuff. And it's just this run of the mill, typical menu that Dustin Hoffman made him cook, you know? And that's the other thing about the movie in that sense is that Favreau's character didn't want to cook that food ever. Like even the first time he had a new menu that he wanted to try out. And you think of this alternate reality where he actually gets to cook the food he wanted to cook and what the probably a good review at that point or something. Like it's one of those things where if you see Platt's character in that light, I think his decision to back him at the end makes complete sense because he's found, you know, his passion, his self again. I think he even, you know, says those things. So yeah, I love that Platt character and I love what it does for the catharsis of this movie because it really, those first two misunderstandings, right? The first cook and the retry, both end up not going the way Favreau wanted them to go. And it, both of those cases, you're like, oh, but if he had just been able to do what he wanted to do, it could have been so different. And then the movie gives you this beautiful journey towards the end of him doing the thing he is passionate about doing and not just cooking, you know, the menu that Dustin Hoffman tells him to cook. And I just think that's really, really beautiful. And something we haven't mentioned, which, you know, is almost text even more than subtext, is how much of a metaphor this is for Favreau with Marvel.
Right.
Right. Like this idea of, you know, Marvel is the big restaurant having to, you know, meet all these things that he's told he has to do. And yes, audiences love it, but he doesn't want to cook for a general audience that is going to love something. He wants to do something he's passionate about that a smaller audience would love. And that is this movie. This movie is Favreau's food truck, you know, and it's, I don't know. There's something really sweet about that and meaningful as you watch the movie.
You have to feel like, I mean, not to interrupt.
Please do.
you have to feel like, I think it's, he's not hiding it. I don't think he's trying to make this like a something you have to look too hard to see the connection.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it kind of makes you wonder how much Marvel was leaning on him on Iron Man 2, which is, I think, the movie that led to Chef. And, you know, it was a big disappointment quality-wise. I think it made plenty of money, but it was a big quality drop-off from the first one, and I feel like Favreau is saying, oh, they made me cook the molten lava cake when I wanted to make, you know, a Cubano, but... anyway, go on.
Well, and I will further interrupt by saying that yes, I agree with you, Aaron, that he's the catalyst for what Jon Favreau needs to do in his life in this movie. I don't agree with him. I don't agree with the truth telling part of it at all. I don't think he's telling the truth. You're right that his job is not to say, well, that's good or bad or whatever. I think when he reaches into the realm of he's gained enough weight because of all the food that's being sent back to the back and all that, that's just wrong. And especially considering the things that they're saying afterwards, like everybody there just, enjoyed it because they are the regulars that come in and they enjoy this food all the time. And they don't know yet that they want to see this different stuff that he wants to cook or whatever. And that is a frustrating part. It gets him on the right thing, but I don't know about this truth telling part of the Oliver Platt character in that. So,
yeah. So I guess I can further explain to say, I don't mean that his clear, barbs in his meanness are the truth telling. Those are the in his mind, I believe, and I'm just taking this from what, you know, what I believe the character in the movie is presenting to me. That's the entertainment part for him. Like he finds entertainment in the meanness, right? Like, and so that's he finds fun in that.
No, I get
but
that.
The truth telling, I think that he's doing is with the food in relation to the chef, right? So he knows something true about the chef that a critic who was just looking at how the food tasted wouldn't necessarily, get to. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the purpose of a food critic is kind of dependent on the critic. Like, as somebody who's, you know, has been a movie critic for a while now, like, I see my purpose when I review a movie for somebody as telling them how they might want to spend their money. You know, like, do you think this, you know, here's what I know about this movie. Now you can make a decision if you think that's worth, you know, spending your money to go see, mm-hmm. kind of thing. Not everybody's like that. In fact, that probably makes me more of a movie reviewer, where a movie critic would actually go more in depth with, you know, the science of movie making and the technical details, yeah. and those kind
and
of things.
And it's really hard to be like watch a movie and then come out with an actual critique the next day, because it requires
right.
that kind of research that you're talking about. Like, you'll see
yes.
people on YouTube all the time, and of course there's many books that get written or whatever. It takes them a month or longer to come out with an actual critique that, like, goes through the whole, that combs through all the things they need to comb through to really truly appreciate a movie and everything. That's, yeah, that's it's a good point for sure.
One thing we should make clear, at least, we don't see any more reviews, so it's really hard for us to know if this is his normal style, but he clearly claims to have discovered Carl, and so I think that may make his review of this restaurant more harsh and more about what the chef could be, because he feels a connection to that chef.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
And for all we know, yeah. if he was reviewing another restaurant down the street where he didn't discover the chef, he would focus more on the food and less on what he didn't get. I don't know.
Well, so in other words, it's like what I felt when I watched Killers of the Flower Moon, and I had this, you know, this great affinity for Martin Scorsese movies over the years, and I'm like, you're better than this, man. You're better than this.
Freaking yeah, kidding, exactly. Man. That movie was a slog.
Yeah. I liked it more than you. Let's move on. The other thing I wanted to talk about is actually agreement, not a disagreement, which is, I think the Robert Downey Jr. part just doesn't fit this movie. I just think it could be cut. I totally agree with that. I will say, I think it's in here as a testament to Favreau doing what the movie is talking about, which is, things are better when you're at your passion level and doing it with people you love. And he loves Robert Downey Jr. Like, you clearly, they are good friends. They love doing stuff together. They love hanging out. And so it's kind of a result of this movie being that for him, to just do the thing he loves with the people he loves. Even though I totally agree, as far as a movie is concerned, it doesn't really fit with the rest of the movie to me. The other things I wanted to mention, I think Dustin Hoffman deserves so much praise for his performance in this movie. He plays that guy so perfectly. As somebody who has had program directors at radio stations like this, where it's like they just can't see the creative side of things. It's all very much about, you know, do this list of things and that's going to get the result. Mm-hmm. He's so good. You hate him at the same time as you understand him. Like, you understand that person. Not saying that he's right or anything, but, well, like, it's a real trick to do with a character like that.
There's that one line where he says, everybody else who's coming tonight is not a critic, or something along those lines.
Yeah.
And that is the line that sells that character for me. And, yeah, we do hate him because he's an impediment for Carl, but we understand him. He's a villain whose logic makes sense to me.
Well, and right. going back to that movie studio analogy that we're talking about here, I mean, that's something that I wonder about all the time when they do something. Marvel does something like, let's hire Edgar Wright. We like Edgar Wright. Like, why the fuck did you hire that guy just to do the thing that you have always been doing, instead of just letting him do something else with it or whatever?
Well, and they've kind of learned that lesson as they started hiring, like, people who made Robot and Frank and stuff like that. Like,
yeah.
People who don't have necessarily the clout to throw around.
Right. So I totally see that. And I do wonder if a lot of that is going through his mind. Why, it almost has to be, right? Because there's I was about to say there's so many Marvel characters in this. There's only a couple of actors, but yeah. but like with their inclusion in this movie, you sort of got to wonder about stuff like that, right? Like is he telling a movie studio story through food throughout this?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah, feels like it. He has definitely experienced the things that this chef is experiencing, if nothing else. Yeah. Just a couple other things. I really love the way the Twitter stuff is visualized here. It was one of the first times I'd seen a movie really do it this way, and I think it makes a lot of sense. It also is in many weird ways nostalgic.
Yes.
For a time of Twitter when it made sense and worked for the thing that it was supposed to do.
I made the joke, ha ha Vine, but I could have made the joke, ha ha Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then there are a couple subtle things I wanted to touch on. One are the relationships in this movie and how authentic and real they feel and how the movie doesn't do the same thing every other movie does. Let's talk about Bobby Cannavale's character, right? Like, he sticks around and cooks after the chef is fired and leaves instead of walking out with him. In any other movie, that makes him, you know, a bad guy. And maybe there's redemption later or whatever, but this movie has him like in the next scene buddying up at a bar and cracking jokes with it. And it's perfect. It feels so, and he does the thing like, yeah, what am I supposed to do? I had to do it, man. You know, like that kind of thing. And you kind of go, oh yeah, that's a real human being who has his own things to think about. And just the movie's really good at that human mm-hmm. stuff. And, you know, all the relationships feel really authentic in that way. And then just, I think the editing in this is really good. You mentioned the kettle corn cut.
Yeah.
That is such it's almost a subtle cut. Like, that trope happens all the time where somebody will say, this will never happen, cut mm-hmm. to it happening. And the way this movie does it doesn't feel tropey. It just feels like you're supposed to kind of notice it. It doesn't make a big yeah. deal about yeah. it. I think that's beautiful. I just think that's really well done stuff. I think Favreau's really, really talented, and I'm really glad
like
he made this movie.
Do more of this kind of thing, unless
yeah,
less like he didn't do. So he did the Jungle Book, and then the first live action Lion King, right?
For Disney? Yeah, and he's also isn't he doing the Grogu movie? I can't remember.
He did the Mandalorian. That's right. That's what he's been doing.
Yeah.
He did stuff like Cowboys and Aliens and Zathura. And
I think Zathura is actually a pretty decent movie.
It's,
but
it's
yeah,
Elf is a freaking classic in my house.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
He did it's do true. Lion King, and it looks like in development he's got the Mandalorian and Grogu, and he's got Jungle Book 2. That's an IMDb may or may not happen type of thing, but I'm assuming he also did Elf too. He also got
so maybe we need a sequel to Chef where Chef Carl Casper is going back right. to Dustin Hoffman's
restaurant.
But
it's so perfect, right? Like Jungle Book 2 is the molten lava
yes.
cake, right? Like a lot of people are gonna like that, and
you know what? I don't blame him. I don't blame him at all.
Yeah.
I'll give him the same pass I gave Bobby Cannavale's character. Just, you know, do what you want to do, man. It's mm-hmm. just
yeah.
you don't seem to be practicing now what you were preaching 10 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All right, let's get on to our super secret double feature.
The best piece of financial advice I've ever received is to pay yourself first. That's why now with every paycheck I receive, I start by putting a little bit away for those rainy days. Today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Acorns is a financial wellness app that makes it easy to start saving and investing for your future. Acorns lets you get started with the spare money you've got right now, even if all you've got is spare change. You don't need to be an expert. Acorns recommends a diversified portfolio that can help you weather all of the market's ups and downs. Using Acorns, before I knew it, I had a couple $1,000s in a little nest egg account. Sign up now and join the over 14 million all-time customers who have already saved and invested over $25 billion with Acorns. Head to acorns.com/49ers or download the Acorns app to get started. Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Tier 1 compensation provided. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/49ers.
Shh. Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone. I've got
a secret. All right, Aaron, what do you think?
Sure. As mentioned, Liar Liar certainly was prevalent with the father-son stuff in this movie, but I actually went the food angle because I wanted to highlight a movie I think has missed a lot of people. I went with 100-Foot Journey. This is Helen Mirren, and probably maybe the only name most people would know from this movie, but this is a story of a Indian immigrants to England who set up shop. I could get some of this wrong. I should probably actually be looking at this before I say it. But anyways, they set up shop across the street from a Michelin restaurant, a Michelin-rated restaurant. I can't remember if it's 3 stars. But and try to create a great restaurant while competing with this other established great restaurant. And there's great food cooking in this movie, but more than that, it is meaningful, emotional, and there's some really, really cool cultural things that happen in this movie about cross culture and those kind of things. So yeah, I think this one has missed a lot of people, and I really enjoyed it, so I wanted to bring a spotlight to the 100-Foot Journey, and it feels like a good double feature with Chef.
Well, it looks like it has Charlotte Le Bon, who was in White Lotus.
Right. She was in this last season of White Lotus. Yeah. That's why I recommended it, because of that.
Right. Uh-huh. Because of that. Yeah, absolutely. I had thought about Liar Liar. I actually thought of the movie Bad Words as well. Jason Bateman movie where he's in the spelling bee. That one seemed like a good one. I think Bad Words is kind of an antidote to this movie though. I guess it would make a pretty good double feature after all, but during the whole road section of this and the kid who's out on the road and all of that reminded me a lot of Almost Famous. So that's my double feature for this movie, Almost Famous, or as you know, you have a, in this case, the teenage kid is actually got his father with him the whole time. So it's not nearly as a dangerous quote unquote situation that, you know, Francis McDormand is worried about the entire time. But I think especially when Sofia Vergara was finally like, come on, take the kid back home already or whatever, I started to get a lot of Almost Famous vibes out of that.
Mm-hmm.
So that is my
story. I like it.
Good this. Stuff.
All right. Let's see. What's our homework for next week, Aaron?
I am excited. I am so excited. This is another underseen movie, and one that I am really, really excited to kind of get into depth on. But this is Charlie Kaufman's Anomalisa.
You're going to make me watch a creepy puppet movie.
I'm going to make you watch an interesting puppet movie.
No, I mean, the puppets are creepy. The movie might be good. The puppets are creepy.
Yes.
I think I love this movie. I can't wait to look at it again.
Yeah, there
was a point, I can't remember what, it might have been during lockdown time or whatever, I watched this and I watched every little feature that was on the Blu-ray about the making of this movie. Nearly didn't get made.
Yeah.
Because it, like even halfway through it, they were almost had to shut this down. But I love Anomalisa. I can't wait to watch this. I think,
nice.
Jeremy, you will like this. Yes, there is some creepiness to it, but I don't think that's going to win the day.
It looks like it's got really good reviews. I took one look at the thumbnail and was like, whoa.
Where can people find Anomalisa?
Anomalisa, I don't know. I didn't check that out. Prime. I think it's on Prime.
My
Google tells me you have to have an MGM Plus paired subscription somewhere.
Maybe it's that thing where it says Amazon, but it means Amazon if you subscribe to something else.
Yeah, it means Prime, but then subscribe to something within Prime, and then you get it. Yeah, that's stupid.
Yeah.
All right, well, you know, most of us will be buying this, I guess. But I have the Blu-ray, ha ha ha.
You
All right, it looks like we have some time for a question or two.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
What song, to the best of your knowledge, that hasn't been used in a fight sequence that should be used in a fight sequence?
I don't have the questions okay, pulled so up right now. Okay, so I will go Jeremy, ahead. You'll have to go first.
I will say I'm going to go with at least one band here that was Nickelback before Nickelback became the punchline. It's Creed. I know this is weird. These are not bands that I would normally recommend for any reason, but every bad band seems to have that one song that I like. And Creed has one called Bullets that I actually enjoy listening to. And I think it would be fantastic on a fight scene. So I would love that. I also, in that same vein, with a lot of anger involved and a lot of aggression and all that, it would be Staind's Not Again, which both of those songs I think would be very rockin' fight songs. And yes, I'm going to, you're going to pull my music appreciation card after recommending Staind and Creed on this podcast.
I was thinking something. I went the opposite direction. I was like, I got to find something happy and boppy that it would be a dissonance with the fight going on the screen. So I went with Maroon 5's Memories. You know that song? Here's to the ones that we got. Here's to the ones that we lost. Bing, bing, wreck all the memory. I just think it would be really funny, especially if it was like Harley Quinn and Margot Robbie beating up somebody, beating up maybe an old friend. I think that would be a really fun kind of music juxtaposition.
This has probably been used, but I couldn't think of where it has, but POD's Boom would be a great like
I
fight
feel like
sequence.
That's probably been used though.
I think
like,
so too, but I couldn't place it if it has.
Like I don't know for a fact, but it feels like in that era, that 2000 to 2005 era, like something like Triple X or something like that used Click Click Boom, but I don't know. I don't know for a fact.
Yeah. Yeah, well, not Click Click Boom. This would be POD's Boom, which is Here Comes the Boom.
Oh,
here
that
comes
song.
Yeah.
Oh, is that the one that says, How You Like Me Now? Is that song?
Yeah.
I think it might be.
I feel like both of them, though, have probably been used, but I can't cite a movie that has done it. So
yeah, that's how
anyway,
I felt,
too. Good answer. There's no
everybody.
Way that's
good
ever been used.
Family Feud. Good answer.
Yeah,
good
exactly.
Answer.
Good answer.
Yeah, that's
good
right.
Answer.
Going over to the chat, Lang says, Reclaim My Place by Korn. Mm. And you know what? Living in that new metal or whatever you want to call it, Korn probably would beat my ass with some new metal. I can't think of what that song is right now, but I can already tell that's probably good. Bangarang by Skrillex is what Castroff says. SOAD says A System of a Down. Bounce by Lang also says that. Leonard Cohen, Hallelujah from Slap. I wish they had used the real version in Watchmen, though, right?
Those bastards couldn't afford it.
I know, exactly. All right. And then the Reforms is used in the Square, Justice by Genesis. Mm. The Queen song in Shaun of the Dead was oddly good, says Shaggy Nuts. And My Milkshake Brings All the Boys to the Yard, says R1A78.
There you go.
All right, that's going to do it for this week. We will be back on Tuesday for the next one, which will be for Anomalisa. And can't wait to go over that movie again. Chat, once again, thank you for coming out to watch us talk about movies. Appreciate it very much. But that's going to do it for this week. We'll see you next time. See
bye,
ya.
Everybody.
Bye.
Bye, guys. Fucking Molten, you asshole.
Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Recco. excuse me while I whip this out.
That's from Blazing Saddles. I'm not just a pervert. Not just a pervert. I'm a pervert who can quote Blazing Saddles.
If Jonathan pays attention to the very beginning of this, he's going to hear me say, oh, God damn it, fuck you guys. And it's going to think that I'm talking about you guys, and I'm not. The that's usually in private, but no, I was trying to look up how to pronounce the name of this author that I'm going to recommend his book on, and I have my idea of how it's pronounced, but like, so I went through like three different interviews, and every single one of them was like, "Hi Adam, hey Adam, hey Adam," and never once introduced him or anything.
Maybe that's for a reason.
That was my number one thing that I did when I ever interviewed people is like, what? How do you pronounce your name? Just tell me if there's anything unusual about it. I want to get it right. And then you say the name, and then people know how that's pronounced. And it's just like nobody else has that fucking common courtesy. It doesn't seem like.
Oh, did you find it, or are you just going to go with Adam? I'm guessing it's Cesar.
I think it's Cesar or Cesare or something like that. Cesari.
Mm. Watch it be like Krivi Krasov.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Oh my God, down the street, about three blocks, there's a house that is just, it's that house in the neighborhood. It's just really trashy, overgrown. And there's a family that lives there. Across the street, for about 6 months, their neighbor across the street had signs along the street naming them by name. Whoa. Across the street saying, please clean up your yard. Wow. And I was like, okay, that's worse than somebody having a messed up yard. Like, that is just evil. Like, calling them out by name with multiple yard signs? That's, like, you're a hateful person.
Oh, yeah.
I understand property values can sometimes be impacted by nearby homes, what have you. Maybe nobody wants to buy a house near a trashy-looking house. But I think there are polite ways to do it. Now, maybe, again, like you were just saying, I'm only seeing the tail end of this. Perhaps this has been going on for years, and they actually did try polite conversation, and it went nowhere. I have no idea. But I was flabbergasted to see those signs because I've never seen anything like that. Isn't there a Simpsons episode, Chris, where like Nelson shoots a bird and feels bad or something? I feel like Nelson is involved.
Ooh.
Bart shoots a bird. I'm gonna look it up.
Yeah, I mean, if it was a lesson show, it would have been Bart. But I don't remember that.
Bart shoots a bird with the BB gun. Feeling guilty, he tries to raise the bird's eggs.
Oh, that's right.
Into lizards instead of birds.
That's right. I remember that now, yeah.
The last 2 years, that was the Orioles. They were winning enough to make the playoffs, but they weren't like world beaters, but they were having fun. This year, they're all fucking miserable. Mm.
It tends to happen when you have a young team that goes out of their minds, and it's like that they sort of forget that whole like what that vibe, I guess, that got them there in the first place. You know, like now that we're considered a good team, we gotta be serious. You know, that type of thing. But
yeah,
you were talking to me and Jonathan about how Baltimore's hitting coach is probably the cause of their woes right now, and
has to be.
And Atlanta's got the same problem. Like they had success doing one particular thing, and then because it kind of fell off just a little bit over the last couple of years, and people forget that baseball is kind of random. They're like, yep. Oh, this approach isn't working. You have to start doing this thing where you try to hit singles all the time and get stolen bases and stuff, because home runs, you can't wait around for the home run and all that. And that's a straw man. You can't, it's not about waiting around for the home run. It's about trying to do the best you can at any particular at bat. And when you see a ball that you can hit, you better fucking hit it hard and don't try to just hit it where they ain't. Type of bullshit that's been permeating baseball for decades, and So yeah, they got a guy who's like, oh, I don't want you to chase after these balls that might be not be strikes. That would be stupid for you to do that. And guess what? Mm. They're not hitting as many home runs as they used to. They're hitting a lot of stupid little dribblers through the infield and stuff like that. And when they win a game, all of a sudden that's considered great because, oh, that they won a game doing that. It must be working. And they won't they'll forget all about that when those same dribblers just go to shortstop and they throw them out at first. So
what's frustrating about the Braves and the Orioles is that it's not like it's a bad team. Mm-hmm. Both are teams full of talent that are playing bad for extended periods of time. Like the Orioles 4 years ago, that wasn't a good team. No one expected them to win. So no one booed when they lost. This is a good team that just can't get anything together. They all collectively forgot how to hit. It's the worst.
Well, and they may have the same kind of hitting coach who's like, oh, you can't wait around for that 3-run home run, man. You can't wait around for it. And they're trying to hit, you know, they're trying to just make contact, quote unquote. And everybody thinks contact is super great when you're an old baseball guy. So, you know, contact isn't everything. You got to hit it hard.
No.
So, and if that's what they're doing, that's part of the problem. A lot of times fans forget that it takes a while for somebody to get comfortable in a new city and there's injuries involved and all that. Francisco Lindor, nobody liked on the New York Mets for like a year or two there. And they're like, that contract is outrageous. And I was like, man, Francisco Lindor is a fucking great baseball player, man. I don't know what you guys are talking about. I know he's not maybe fulfilling your idea of what this contract is. But then now all of a sudden, you know, he's awesome on that team because it takes a while sometimes, especially when you go to a place like New York. And they're always hounding you about a bunch of stupid bullshit, so.
Yep. Winning cures all ills, as they say, yes?
I really honestly believe that baseball should do stuff like that. Like, this is what Premier League, I don't know if they still do this, but, like, you could tune in to, like, fan-based commentary and stuff like that, and it's just fun. It's fun to listen to fans of the two teams announce the game and like have people being able to swear and stuff like that. That'd be awesome. You know,
I've thought about that a lot, actually. Mm-hmm. I think that would be fun.
Yeah, it'd be a lot of fun.
I know that there are a lot of people who love the Orioles commentators, but it's not the same experience. It's kind of like the Manning cast, only without famous people, where you can have a much less serious kind of discussion and running dialogue about the game.
Right.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
Why is life better with American Family Insurance? Because every policy comes with something very special. A trusted agent who's there to help protect your dreams by finding the right coverage at the right price. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.